We're starting a new book tonight, a mysterious book, a powerful book, one that oftentimes churches avoid because it's a mysteriously weird book in some places, but I find even the weird spots are kind of interesting and insightful, and man, there's a lot to learn from Ezekiel, the mysterious, mystic prophet of the Old Testament. If you're taking notes, which, by the way, I would encourage you to do, you might jot down a few things. By the way, you know, people sometimes ask, and I like to from time to time remind people why I use the King James. One, probably the most important reason is you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I've been using the King James since I was 5 years old. And so it's kind of what I use. Now, every now and then I have somebody, you know, comes up to me after church and says, "Oh, Brett, man, I'm so glad you use the King James because, you know, we're part of the King James only movement." And there's a whole group of people that just say King James only. And, you know, it kind of cracks me up because I understand what they're saying, that the King James is a translation that's withstood, you know, hundreds of years of scrutiny as far as a translation goes. But it's a little bit funny to me when you kind of act like, well, if it's good enough for Paul the Apostle, it's good enough for me, you know, this King James. King James wasn't around until 1611, but it's just funny. There's a group that kind of acts that way. But the reason I use it is because I'm used to it. It's what but also, let me give you a few other reasons. I also like the King James because it forces me to slow down and really think about what's being said. I like that part of the King James. Also, I like the poetic nature of the King James language. You know, for some people, it drives them crazy. For others, they call it poetry. I like the poetry of the King James. And then there is, and probably about in this order, then there is the quality of the King James that I very much like of the translation itself. It is a great translation, even though it's a little hard sometimes to discern the King James language of the older English. It definitely has withstood the test of time. But at the same time, sometimes the translators of the King James, you'll hear me talk about that, some of the things, even tonight possibly we'll get into some of that. But honestly, my feelings on most of the translations, if you have any one of the mainline translations, good for you. Go for it. You'll be saved. You'll be a Christian as you read the NIV and the New American Standard and the New Living Translation and the English. You know, all these different translations are great. Now, stay away from the New World Translation, because it's not a translation at all. It's the Jehovah's Witness tweaking of the King James. And stay away from, of course, the Book of Mormon. Those are translations that you are not really translations at all. They're just tweaks. And so stay with the main ones, and it's all good. I like these all the translations. In fact, I use them all. I use them all in my personal study and what have you. But King James is the one that I stick with. Enough on that. But Ezekiel is a guy. I got to figure out who I'm talking about here first. Ezekiel is a guy who is interesting in that he was contemporary with one of three prophets that we call the captivity prophets. He was called a captivity prophet because he was one of the three main prophets that were in the time when the children of Israel were in captivity for 70 years in Babylon. The other two you probably can think of. One is the one we just got through studying in Jeremiah and Lamentations. The prophet Jeremiah was a captivity prophet. Four, you have to remember, even though his captivity would take place after his ministry, he was a prophet during the first several years of the captivity. Remember, one of the things you need to remember is the waves of siege that Nebuchadnezzar laid upon Babylon. That kind of comes into play in Ezekiel. Let me tell you how. Just a quick review. We've gone over this in our previous studies, but if you'll remember, in 605 BC, the first siege by Nebuchadnezzar after that big battle against Pharaoh Necho, he, on the way back, sieged Jerusalem and left there with somewhat of a peaceful exit, but he still took some people into captivity on 605, that first deportation, would also, by the way, included Daniel and his buddies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were taken in 605, the first deportation to Babylon. Then the Jews kind of rose up again against Babylon, and then we got to the second deportation, jot this down, 597 BC. Nebi, who was now the king. He was only the son of the king before when he did the first deportation. This time he's the king, and he comes much more brutally, and he says, okay, Jerusalem, you're under my control. And he takes the second wave of deportations, including Ezekiel, and another one, just for FYI, Jehoiachin. Do you guys remember Jehoiachin? He was taken during that second siege. Now, this will all be important. Ezekiel's part of the second group, 597 BC. And then, of course, our last guy, Jeremiah, 586, was the final deportation to Babylon. And if you're confused by the dates, remember, we're going backwards because it's BC. So the lower the number, the closer to our time it gets. So all this is to say, those three waves, Daniel was the third contemporary of Ezekiel and Jeremiah. They were the three main prophets alive during that time. Now, I find it interesting that Ezekiel never once mentions Jeremiah, but four times he will mention the prophet Daniel. Why is that? Did Jeremiah and Ezekiel not get along? Well, remember, geographically, they were in totally different places, separated by hundreds and hundreds of miles, because Ezekiel began his ministry in Babylon as a captive, whereas Jeremiah began his ministry in Judah and made it all the way through, even to the very end of the final deportation in 586 BC. And if you'll recall, Nebuzaradan was on his way back to Babylon with Jeremiah when he let Jeremiah go, and Jeremiah went back to Judah. So Jeremiah never was carried off into Babylon. And so Jeremiah and Ezekiel probably didn't even know each other. Kind of interesting. But Daniel and Ezekiel were probably acquainted, as they were great prophets of God during the same era. So those are the three contemporaries: Daniel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Now, all of them are very different in style. Where Jeremiah was the weeping prophet who you kind of sense the whole time through Lamentations in the book of Jeremiah, he's struggling. Lord, what's going on? What do I do? His head's a fountain. He's constantly crying. Whereas Ezekiel is what I would call much more of a solid, just face set like flint to do what God tells him to do. And if anything, instead of being weeping, he gets hot under the collar. Ezekiel's got maybe even a bit of a temper. We might even see that a bit tonight. But a righteous temper, a righteous anger that I will see. Plus, Ezekiel never really, we don't see him waver like, should I do this thing that the Lord's telling me to do? He seems to just kind of do what God tells him to do. He's a little less sensitive, perhaps. But at the same time, Jeremiah is very practical. Ezekiel is very mystical. And he talks about flames enveloping flames and wheels within wheels and all kinds of deep thinking type analogies and visions that Ezekiel's going to have. And some of them, we're not even going to be sure really what they are. But Ezekiel is the guy who will give us those things. And so Ezekiel, a very different guy. He just for your information, was kind of a normal guy in that even in Babylonian captivity, he owned his own house and he was married, which later his wife would die and he was forbidden to mourn the loss of his wife. We'll get into that. We'll talk about that. Ezekiel would be given the task to prophesy concerning visions of future things that are probably even future for us. He would see battles that would be modern day battles, and he would try in his Old Testament brain to describe what would be going on, perhaps even including an invasion from the north, from Russia down into Israel. It's one of those battles the Bible talks about in the future that's going to happen. We'll get into that in some of the later chapters where it's kind of interesting, even as today, the stage is set in the Middle East for Russia to come down. It's a hungry bear up there in Russia. And they're definitely rising up in power from, you know, the whole thing that took place back when the Soviet Union broke apart. And we're seeing some interesting changes in the last several decades that Ezekiel's going to talk about that stuff. So powerful and important, interesting stuff. So he's a mysterious prophet. Ezekiel's name means God will strengthen. And we're going to see the Lord use Ezekiel in that role, but mostly toward the end of the book, he will be the strengthening prophet, even as his name talks about. So the best way, I guess, to do this is just to dive right in. Great and glorious book here. By the way, one more thing. The theme, if you could make a theme of the book of Ezekiel, is this: the sovereignty and the glory of God. The sovereignty and the glory of God. In fact, chapter one here that's before us is going to just show us the glory that is on and around the throne of God. Chapter one is going to give us just a little snapshot of what it looks like in heaven. Now, some people say, what's the deal with Ezekiel chapter one? It's so mysterious and weird. But honestly, one of the reasons I like studying, among many others, but one of the reasons I like studying Ezekiel chapter 1 and diving in a little bit is because when I get to heaven, the last thing I want to be is a tourist. Man, I want to know where, okay, here's the throne and this is the firmament and these are the cherubims and the seraphim. I want to be able to say, this is what's going on. And unto your right, you notice over here, you got the 420 elders. And I'd love to be able to say, this is what's going on. Have you ever been just a real nerdy tourist somewhere? I have. I had an 8-hour layover in Paris once on my way to Africa. You know, 8 hours, that's a lot of time to get something done. So I left the airport, got on the train, went down to downtown Paris from the Charles de Gaulle airport. And, man, you know, I don't know one lick of French at all, not one word, except for, you know, oui. But, so, you know, I'm running all around Paris trying to figure out where I'm going. I was trying to find the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower. I just didn't know they called it the Tower Eiffel. It's like the French have it backwards. It's the Eiffel Tower, not the Tower Eiffel. But anyway, you know, I found the Eiffel Tower, went up, went down, went into the Louvre, ran through. Just really fast, just kind of your fast. And, you know, you're supposed to kind of spend like a day or two at the Louvre. You don't just run through the Louvre. But as a tourist, I was nerding out, and I'm sure all the French people were going, those Americans, there's the typical American right there. You know, total tourist. But I just had 8 hours, so I made the most of it. But here's the thing. We are to study Ezekiel not as tourists, but to say we're coming as explorers. We want to know what the book is about. And don't you want to kind of get a glimpse of what that heavenly scene is going to be like? When we stand before the Lord, before his throne, Ezekiel gives us a snapshot here to look at. He's going to struggle. You'll sense a struggle. Even in the Hebrew language, the Hebrew scholars tell us that you can get the sense that Ezekiel is desperately trying to give us imagery, but he's a bit frustrated in his attempt to describe what he's seeing. He will use words that, you know, that these things are very similar to or likened unto or kind of like. He uses those phrases only in the Hebrew language to indicate that he really doesn't know exactly how to describe what he's saying. Now, some people, that frustrates them. But for me, doesn't frustrate me at all. I'll tell you why. Because if heaven were real easy to explain, if the throne of God were, oh, well, there's a big chair and big light bulb behind God. I mean, then that would be a little discouraging. You get to see God and you look behind the chair and there's a little light bulb back there. You know, it's like, nah, that's not heaven. No, I'm kind of glad that Ezekiel's going to struggle a bit with his description of heaven because it is glorious. In fact, you might even want to jot this down. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9, here's what Paul declares. He says, but as it is written, I have not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, just these awesome, wonderful things that are going to be waiting for us in heaven. So you can understand then why Ezekiel, seeing things that eyes have not seen, nor ears even heard about, he's going to struggle even in his description, but I'm glad about that. So let's take a look here and see. The first four verses, we kind of have the intro of this first chapter and really of the whole book. It says in chapter 1, verse 1, now it came to pass in the 13th year, pardon me, the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, or Buzi, in the land of Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. So we start out with Ezekiel. Now, let's talk about the date just a little bit. We know that this is a few years into the captivity of Ezekiel. We also believe, as you read there, it's a little bit debated among the scholars. That's the 30th year of what? Did you see that? Now, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month. The 30th year of what? Well, most scholars agree the 30th year of Ezekiel's life. They believe he was 30 years of age at this point when he gets this great vision and the prophecies we're about to read. 30 years old. Now, that's significant, especially when you relate it to verse 3. The word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest. You see, in the old Torah, the first five books of the Bible, there were specific rules that were related to the priest and the office of the priest. I find it interesting. And that is, if you were a priest or the son of a priest, you would begin your training at the age of 20. And then from 20 to the age of 30, you'd just keep working as a trainee. But then when you turned 30, that's when you would take up the full-blown office of the priesthood. And you'd serve from 30 until the age of 50. Then from 50 till the day they die, they would train the 20s to the 30 people. You know, those younger guys. And that's the model they used. And so interesting, if you kind of think it through, chances are Ezekiel was being trained as a young priest in Judah back when he was a young boy, being trained up until his training was cut short when he was taken into captivity. Now he's in Babylon and the priesthood is pretty much out the window. Ezekiel, you can pretty much chalk off being a priest. You're not anywhere near the temple and there are no priests. There is no worship happening here. And really you could say, well, Ezekiel, you're just a captive prisoner. You're toast. But I love it here. The Lord seems to be unfolding his own agenda for Ezekiel. He's going to definitely call him to ministry now in his 30th year. Here's the thing I want to point out about that. You might be raised or trained or have skills in areas that, you know, you feel like God has raised you up for a purpose. But oftentimes, the Lord will use you or use his people in different ways than originally we thought he would use us. Think of Moses. They're trained in the courts of Pharaoh to be the king of Egypt for 40 years. And then stuck out the desert for 40 more years tending a flock of sheep. And then finally leading, definitely in a kind of a leadership role, even as he was trained to be a leader in his young days, now he's a leader, but not like the Pharaoh leader. He's actually a leader like a shepherd kind of leader. Do you remember the stick that Moses had? The Lord told Moses there, he said, take your staff and throw it on the ground. And so he did. And the Lord caused it to become a serpent. He said, now pick it up. Only pick it up by the tail. And so he picked it up by the tail, and which is not the way you pick up a snake, unless you're the crocodile hunter guy. But he seemed to pick up snakes by the tail. But I never picked up snakes by the tail. But that's what Moses did. He picked it up. And the thing is, when he picked it up, it became his staff again. And you know the story. The Lord used his staff and what have you. But the thing that I find interesting is the Lord used Moses, his staff, which is a symbol of authority. Before Moses could use his staff, he had to throw it down and pick it up in a different way. And then the Lord used his authority in a whole other way than he was trained. Don't be surprised if you plan your life. And you study and you learn and you go to school and you do what you do to try to get somewhere where you want to go when the Lord just kind of shifts everything and has you do a whole nother thing. Don't be jolted by that, but celebrate that. Because I have found if you just go with the flow with what the Lord is doing in your life, you'll be way better off anyway. Ezekiel's not going to really fulfill that role of a priest, even though that's his title starting right here in verse 3. He's one of the priests. He's at the age of 30 when he should be starting his priestly ministry. But now he's taking on a whole new role. He's going to be a prophet. Now, here's the thing that's interesting. Ezekiel gets the tag historically by the rabbis as the one who restructured temple worship. In fact, even though he never really served in the temple there in Jerusalem, he would be responsible for changing the way worship would be done. And we'll see how and why that comes out when we read the latter part of Ezekiel. In chapter 44, it talks about the priests and what they were to do. There were some changes that Ezekiel would have and he would make. So he would influence and affect the priesthood, but only in a very different way. But one other thing before we leave that notion about the priest and the age. Sometimes I wonder about ministry and young men who want to be pastors or young women who want to jump into ministry and stuff. And I think that there's a neat Old Testament model that maybe we could employ and perhaps use. And that is that they were 20 years old when they began to really serve and help. It's kind of like our culture. You know, 18, you get out of high school, then you get through college, 22, 23, and then you start doing your thing. But in ministry, wouldn't it be cool if we had a bunch of 20-year-olds that just said, okay, I'm here to serve, to help, to step up, to learn. And then as that training takes place, to perhaps even use the biblical model and see, you know, 30-year-olds go out and start doing the work of full-time pastoring or ministering or missionary work. Sometimes I think the church makes an error in one of two ways. Either they go too soon or too late. Some denominations say, no, you have to have gray hair and you better be 50 or 60 before you really are a pastor or respected in ministry. By the way, that's one of Tad's challenges over in Vanuatu. We have these young, anointed men that know the scriptures and want to teach the word. But in Vanuatu culture, if you're not an older man, and definitely if you're not married, you are not to be in the ministry. Where did they get that? Well, not from the Bible, because then you would exclude Paul and Jesus. Two fairly major features of the New Testament church, wouldn't you say? And so Tad is trying to show the Vanuatu people that these young men are qualified, whether they're married or not, and that they can be serving in the ministry at younger ages. The Vanuatu people need to learn that biblically. And even in some of our mainline denominations, there's an age thing like that. Or we swing the other way, where we do what Paul warned young Timothy. He said, Timothy, be careful that you lay hands not on a man suddenly. Laying hands on a man means laying on a hand, praying blessing upon that man's life and ministry, recognizing him as an ordained minister. By laying on of hands suddenly, that means without that young man doing some time and proving that he's called into the ministry. I think it could be a good model for us, not to be legalistic about it, but to see our 20-something-year-old guys being trained up in the ministry. And then when they get to that 30-ish age, that the Lord might use them as the guys who are just doing the hard work of the ministry, or the gals that are helping out and around the church and in missionary work and what have you. Anyway, that's the way it was in the Bible times. So Ezekiel's beginning his ministry at the right time, only in a different way than what he had planned. Now, there's a few phrases here you need to note before we move on. Verse 1, notice it says, the heavens were opened. Last part of verse 1, I saw visions of God. And then the third little phrase I'd like to draw your attention to is verse 3, the word of the Lord came. Those three phrases are important, especially to the Jewish audience. They would recognize that as powerful and important stuff. Ezekiel's taking it to the top level right out of the gate here. Because as soon as you said, the word of the Lord came to me, you better be right. Why? Do you remember what they did to prophets? They said, the word of the Lord says this. And if they were wrong, what'd they do to the guy? Stone him to death. So he's sticking his neck on the line right now saying, I'm speaking the word of the Lord. And he's saying that the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Now, the reason I draw attention to that is because all throughout the scripture, when men would see the heavens open and they would either see the Lord or hear from the Lord, man, they were impacting, life-changing times. Jot a few of these down maybe in your Bible. Do you remember Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1? There, the heavens were opened. Isaiah said, in the year King Uzziah died, Isaiah said, I saw the Lord high and lifted up upon his throne. Man, that's awesome. We'll talk about Isaiah 6 because there's some massive parallels here with Ezekiel 1. But Isaiah saw that. Isaiah 6, chapter 6, jot that down. Also, Matthew chapter 3, verse 16. Do you remember when the heavens were opened up there? It was during what? Jesus' baptism, right? As he was baptized, it says the heavens were opened. And so what a monumental, life-changing time for the whole world, really, there. Not only Matthew 3:16, but also Acts chapter 7. You guys remember the story of Stephen, who was preaching that powerful sermon, and the people brought him out to stone him to death. And it says that Stephen, his face shined and glowed, and he looked and he said, I see heaven open up. Heaven opening. Another massive time. Or you could go on Paul when he was on the road to Damascus, or Revelation chapter 19, verse 11, when Jesus returns, the heavens are going to open up. The point that I'm making is this. Every time you see in the Bible the heavens opened, hold on to your hat. Massive, huge, cataclysmic spiritual events happened in the world's history. But not only for the world's history, but for the individuals who were there. When the heavens were opened, it was a life-changing event. They'd hear the word of the Lord. The Mount of Transfiguration, Peter said, Lord, it's good for us to be here. And the Lord comes out and speaks out, and he says, this is my beloved son, hear ye him. Zip it, Pete. Paraphrase. Pretty big times. And really, the reason I say that is this time for Ezekiel is a big, big time of seeing into the throne room of heaven. And it changed his life from this day forward. And that's my prayer for us, that as we read the book of Ezekiel, it'll be life-changing for us as well. Every time we see the heavens opened up here in the Word, let it be a life-changer for us. Well, verse 4, and I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud. That's appropriate for tonight, as we have 60-mile-per-hour winds. So we got the kind of the visual aid here, too. He looked and saw a whirlwind out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself. And a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof was the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Now, mark that word amber and write this, bright and shining, because really that's the word that's used there. It's not even as much a color. See, when we think of amber, we're thinking of chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Amber. It's a warm glow. No, the Hebrew word, we don't really have an English word that translates from the word that the Hebrews use, but it was the idea of very bright and very shining with definitely kind of a warmth to it, but it was kind of a silver, gold, bright and shining. And it's a word that we really don't have an its equal in the English. That's just kind of an important thing. Do you get the sense something's great coming? A whirlwind, fire enfolding upon itself, or as your margin reads, catching up with itself? Fire? See, we're already headed down some pretty strange territory here. But it gets even more strange. And really, we have four sections now that we're going to look at. First of all, we're going to see the four living creatures, number one. And then number two, we will see the four wheels. And then number three, we'll see the expanse, the great expanse. And then number four, we'll see the actual throne itself. And that'll be chapter one. So first of all, the four living creatures. And man, I'm going to zip through this, so get your pencils ready. There's some notes we're going to make about these creatures. It says also, verse 5, out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Now, first of all, we got to figure out, who are these creatures? Well, if you're a Bible student and you reflect on some other passages, jot down these in your notes, Isaiah chapter 6 and Revelation chapter 4. We have very, very similar accounts given by those men. John the Apostle in the book of Revelation and Isaiah saw this same snapshot, but there are some interesting little differences that each of them have. And what are those differences? Some people like to say, contradiction in the Bible. And to me, that's just jumping way quickly to conclusions. To me, I believe it's very easy to picture Isaiah or John seeing the same snapshot only from a different perspective. And you could very easily see that and make that argument. But also you have to understand that perhaps they are at different times. And they might be describing not the exact same creatures. Now, we're going to find out in Ezekiel chapter 10 the name of these creatures. They're called cherubim. Cherubim. Now, in Isaiah chapter 6, they are called seraphim. Okay, so what's the difference between a cherubim and a seraphim? I don't know. There might be massive differences, but the idea as we read it here in Ezekiel and compare it with Isaiah, there's definitely similarities. Maybe some different numberings of things. Maybe they look a little different. Maybe they're the same exact creatures, just called different things. We can't really be certain. But it would seem that the Bible does differentiate between the cherubim and the seraphim. What are they? Well, most scholarship agrees they are some of the highest forms of angelic beings. These are real creatures. I want you to understand this. These are real creatures. I believe that when we someday stand before the Lord and see Him in heaven, in the heavenly scene, we will see seraphim and cherubim. I know it's that you think, man, are you kidding me? We're going to see these things? Come on. Well, yeah, wait till you read about them. It's going to be, you know, make Lord of the Rings look like a cakewalk. I mean, these creatures are incredible, and they're hard for Ezekiel to describe, but I believe when we get to heaven, we're going to see these creatures. They are real beings, and the things that we can know just quickly right off the bat is they're beings that are submitted to God, serving God, and according to the book of Revelation chapter 4, they are worshiping God all the time. And the point that I make is, as we look at these creatures, I want you to notice their characteristics, because each of their characteristics speak to their nature, what these beings do, who they are. In fact, the rabbinical teachers have some interesting correlations between the symbols of the Levitical priesthood. And so I'm just going to take you through some quick descriptions. Ezekiel would have understood some of these images. We lose it because of thousands of years of time have passed and we're not Jews worshiping in the tabernacle of the Old Testament. There would be a help if you were an old timer from that day, knowing the Levitical priesthood, knowing the way camp was set up, knowing the way worship was done. This whole picture would mean just that much more. So I'll try to give you a little of a snapshot of this as we keep going. You might say, come on, is this really happening? Yeah. This we're going to see this stuff. You know, we as people, we like to pay attention to the weirdest little things. People don't like to pay attention to Ezekiel because it just seems a little far-fetched or weird or out there. But man, it'll pay off. I was reading in Forest Grove, this was actually on MSNBC, but it comes from Forest Grove, Oregon. The chosen professional interest of biologist David Scholnick of Pacific University is now studying how shrimp act when they get an infection. This is his life study, shrimp infection. And what he does is he gauges their strength when they've been infected by building a little tiny treadmill in order to run these crustaceans through their paces to measure blood lactate levels and what have you. As far as I know, Scholnick told LiveScience.com in October, he said, this is the first time that shrimp have been exercised on a treadmill. To increase shrimp's stress, Scholnick designs tiny backpacks out of duct tape, but still found that healthy shrimp could go for more than an hour without any fatigue. So this guy is spending his life studying shrimp on treadmills that he makes. Hey, listen, if he can do that, we can take an evening and just study the glories of Ezekiel's description of what heaven is going to look like, what the throne of God's going to look like. So here we go. Let's say it says there they had the likeness of man. Mark this, number one, humanity. There's a bit of humanity in these creatures. Even though they're very far from humanity, there's a little bit of humanity, which in their service to the Lord, this model for ministry that these cherubim offer to us, notice that the Lord can use us, humans, people. God chooses to use the weak and the foolish things in this world, and that's a powerful thing. Now, in Hebrews, there's an indication that someday we will be over the angels, which I'm sure the angels are just holding their breath for that one. Man, these humans are going to be in charge of us? And the Lord seems to indicate that. And I don't know about these seraphim or cherubim, but when you read about these guys, it's hard to even imagine us having anything to do with these things. But there is that sense of a little bit of humanity. We'll see a little more of that as we continue. So number one, humanity, or the first one, Number two, everyone had four faces and everyone had four wings. So these four faces, we're going to see that a little bit more as we go, but we know people with two faces, some of us, the two-faced people, but these cherubim, are four-faced. And so it goes on there, and it says that, verse 7, and their feet were straight feet. Straight feet. Again, Ezekiel would have recognized this kind of language in his priesthood training, which would speak of stability. Stability. These were creatures of humanity, yes, but they were also creatures of stability. Listen, one of the things I think the Lord looks for is a man or a woman who's stable in their walk, not wavering to and fro, one minute being totally depressed and blue, the next minute being happy and good. The Lord wants people who will just walk steadily and progressively with Him. And none of this, you know, sinning really bad on one day and then trying to be righteous on another. There's something about the person who walks with God day and night, just keeps walking steadily. Stability. Straight feet. And the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. Now a calf speaks of, or an ox, as it were, speaks of service and what have you. But notice here, it says here that they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. So this service brings us to our third thing. We see number one, we see humanity. Number two, stability. But number three, purity. It says here that the feet, the calf's foot, sparkled like the color of burnished or shined brass. Now, there's a lot of imagery here. Burnished brass, shining brass, was a symbol of judgment. But the ox or the calf was a symbol of service, as the ox would tread out the corn and what have you. And so the idea here, Ezekiel would have known, the redemptive work, the judgment work that was made shiny, made it so that the calf, that's us, could be serving. That's kind of the implication there. None of us deserve to serve the Lord. None of us qualify. None of us are worthy. But because of the Lord's purifying work, the judgment that was placed upon His Son makes it possible for you and I to serve Him in some capacity. That's pretty impressive. So you've got purity there in the sparkling burnished brass. So verse 8, and they had hands of a man. The hands of a man speak of practicality. Just a practical, you know, ability to do service, to work, the hands of a man, practicality. And under their wings on their four sides, they had, and they four had their faces and their wings. Verse 9, and their wings were joined one to another. So these four creatures, cherubim, their wings are joined together or touching together, which speaks of unity, unity. So you've got humanity, stability, purity, practicality, unity. And it says there, and they turned not when they went. They went everyone straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they had the face, one of a man, the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side. They four also had the face of an eagle. We'll talk about that in a second. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Notice their faces, and it says their wings were stretched upward, which speaks of priority. Their priority was focused upward on the Lord, who is high and lifted up upon His throne. These cherubim focused upward, and their priority was the Lord. But then the last part of verse 11, the two wings, everyone were joined one to another, and the two covered their bodies. So with two wings, they covered themselves, which speaks of humility. To be effective in service, man, we need to be humble. Humble thyself in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up, the Bible says. And so these creatures are a good model for ministry in that they had unity, they had priority, they had humility. And then verse 12, and they went everyone straight forward. We saw that in verse 9 too. They turned not when they went. They went everyone straight forward. That speaks of integrity. Straight forward. That's what the Lord wants in His people that serve Him, is integrity. What a sad thing it is that the world looks at the church today and sees dishonesty and, you know, all kinds of weirdness, and our political people are jockeying, looking at this most recent Reverend Ted Haggard and what happened. I'd never even heard of this pastor until this whole thing came up last week or the week before last. Tragic. Tragic for him personally, because he pretty much messed up his whole life. That's pretty tough. But tragic in a lot of sense, for that's the view that the world will have of the church. And it's a terrible testimony. It breaks my heart to see what the church, the way the church gets dragged through all this stuff because of really one man's sin. And so we need to be careful to be, if we're truly going to be ministering, we need to be ministering in integrity. And so that brings us on. So they went, everyone straight forward, integrity. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went. That speaks of availability. Availability. Wherever the Spirit went, they went. They were available to do whatever the Spirit led them to do. I hope we're all like that. Are you one that struggles to break out of your routine? You know, you're driving home and you just get the sense to pick up the hitchhiker. Or you're there at the gas pump and the Lord's putting on your heart to talk to the person, but instead it's cold outside, so you roll up your window. Maybe the Lord wanted you to share the gospel in a short time. You know, it takes a while for your tank to fill up. You can sneak a gospel message in if you want. I learned that from my buddy Dave Steikoff. We were lost in the middle of East LA at the middle of the night. It's a long story how we got there, but he and I, we had this big old school bus, and we were driving down to Mexico. But we stopped in East LA at midnight, and we went to this gas station. It was scary. I mean, you know, there was just, you kind of thought, man, we're going to get shot here or something. So we're filling up, I'm filling up the bus, you know, and it was an old 69 International, ran on just regular fuel, and I was just there pumping. And then this guy, this really old, big Cadillac comes up, and he and his family's in there, and I'm pretty sure that puffs of pot was smoke was kind of coming out of the windows, and this guy comes up, hey man, do you have any money? And you know, I was just kind of getting ready to say, take a hike, buddy. No. And Dave's like, well, actually, what do you need? And the guy said, oh, I need some gas for my car here, you know. And I'm just thinking, oh brother, you know, it's a big gas hog here. He wants us to. And Dave said, well, tell you what, I'd love to fill. So he grabs the gas, the nozzle out of my hand, the pump, and he opens up the license plate there and sticks it in, and he starts talking. But I notice that Dave, he puts it on the slowest setting. And it's trickling, you know, 1/10, 2/10, you know, just really slow. And Dave just starts totally sharing the gospel message with this guy. And I'm just, you know, kind of stunned and watching my buddy. You got to understand, Dave's this old surfer guy. Hair was down to his waist, and he was just kind of this scraggly looking guy. And he's just talking about Jesus, and this guy's going, oh man, don't be talking about that stuff. And his family's like, honey, what's going on out there? You know, and the kids are crying, and the but Dave's just 5/10. 6/10. And, you know, this Cadillac had some huge gas tank or something, because we were there for what seemed like about 5-10 minutes. By the end of the pump time, the guy was in tears accepting Jesus Christ as his personal Savior. And I realized, you know, at that point, you can lead a person to Christ in the time it takes to fill up your gas tank. Are you the kind of person that likes to be in your little routine? And man, if the Holy Spirit leads you, you're just going, no, don't want to get out of my routine. Or are you one that when the Spirit leads, you move? Are you available for that kind of a Spirit-filled, Spirit-led life? My challenge to you is to loosen up. Be sensitive to the Spirit's prompting. Because these cherubim seem to be, it says, whatever way the Spirit was to go, they went. And they turned not when they went. I love that. Availability. So far we've got number one, humanity, number two, stability, number three, purity, number four, practicality, number five, unity, number six, priority, number seven, humility, number eight, integrity, number nine, availability, two more, and the next one is intensity. Look at verse 13. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. And like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright. And out of the fire went forth lightning. Man, dramatic scene here. But notice it says here that the creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. Man, I like that. When a Christian has a lightness shining through them, this burning passion that they have for the Lord. And these cherubim definitely had an intensity that I desire to have. But then lastly, the final one, what are we on, number 11? Activity. Verse 14. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. So these cherubim, while they're there at the throne, there's moments where there's pew, pew, and they just get stuff done. There's in and out, man. These activity and quickness. Bible says, whatsoever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men. I fear sometimes we as Christians take on kind of that casual coffee break mentality where we just kind of stand around as Christians and say, hey man, how's it going? And we're just there kind of chilling. And that's fine too. I like that, the low key thing. But there's times when it's really time to just get busy and have activity as we serve the Lord and just get it done. And I think sometimes we become a little too lackadaisical. One old preacher said, the Lord cannot and will not use a lazy man. And I sort of have seen that as the years go by, as I watch different people who work and then others who just sit around and do nothing. And they say, well, why don't I have a Bible study? Or why don't I get to go on the mission field? And the chances are they're just sitting around going, well, I'm open, Lord, whatever, I'm open. Can't steer a parked car. And so here, these creatures are a good example for us in ministry because they were active, activity. Well, that brings us to the second section of this chapter. We move from the four creatures. Oh, before I leave that, there's a major theme I kind of forgot. Boy, I wish we had a lot of time for this one. But in verse 10, their faces, that's worthy of some serious consideration. Why did they have four faces? Well, just keep in mind, God is not limited to our little bodies here on this earth and our human form. You know, for those of you that are kind of Trekkies or Star Trek fans or into extraterrestrials or whatever, you know, I don't know about all that stuff. I think that's mostly wacko. But if you're into that stuff, drop the Star Trek thing and start studying the Bible. Because look at these creatures. I mean, you know, this makes the, you know, remember the, back, I remember back when I was a kid, Star Wars first came out, and then remember the, there was the bar scene there. And all those little creatures. And man, I just thought, oh, this is so cool. These little snort things and little heads sticking out with an eyeball. And man, I thought, man, George Lucas. But this makes George Lucas look like a wimp. We got these cherubim. Man, study this. Four faces on these creatures. But notice the description here is really intriguing. They have one is the face of a man. One's the face of a lion. One's the face of an ox, one of an eagle. There's some symbology here that's huge. But let me just encourage you, first of all, if you're really interested and you want to study these, study Isaiah chapter 6. In fact, let me just read to you quickly the description there. You don't have to turn there because we're running out of time, but jot this down, read it later. It's Isaiah 6, 1, it says, in the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, his train filled the temple, and above it stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried to another and said, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. So, you know, then you know the whole thing where he says, woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. And, you know, the Lord comes there, the seraphim comes with a coal and puts it on the lips of Isaiah. Tsst. Remember that story? You're saying, yeah, that doesn't sound very good. Yeah, it was his speech was unclean. But that was Isaiah's view of this heavenly scene. Does it sound familiar? Check out John's account in Revelation chapter 4. I'll read it to you. There in Revelation 4, it says, after this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was, as it were, a trumpet talking with me. And he said, come up hither. By the way, I think that's a picture of the rapture. You got the churches in Revelation 2 and 3. And then in chapter 4 and 5, you've got the heavenly scene. But the first words of chapter 4 is, come up hither, the trumpet, the voice of a trumpet. But that's a whole other thing. I don't want to get off on that tonight. Immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, one who sat on the throne, and he that sat up was to look upon like a jasper stone, a sardine stone. There was a rainbow round about the throne. Keep that in mind, rainbow. And it was the sight unto like an emerald. And round about the throne sat 24 seats. Upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting. Notice, the 24 elders aren't in Isaiah's description nor Ezekiel's description. There's a reason for that. Don't have time to go into it, but you can study this later. let's move on. Then it says, before the throne, verse 6 of Revelation 4, there was a sea of glass like unto crystal. We'll see that in a moment. And around about the throne were four beasts. Now, the word beast there in the book of Revelation is an unfortunate translation. This is one of those King James translations I wish they would have gone with the right term, and that is creature. Well, what's the difference? Creature, beast, same thing. Well, that's what the King James translators thought. But the problem is the confusion. There is a word beast in the book of Revelation that's not so good. Do you know what I'm talking about? The Antichrist, right? And it's the same word they employ, beast, in the English, when in actuality there are two different Greek words that describe the beast, Antichrist, and the beasts, these cherubim that are being talked about. It's actually better creature or creation of God. So it says there were beasts full of eyes before and behind. Now, we haven't seen the eyes yet in Ezekiel, but we will. Check this out. And the first beast was like a lion, the second like a calf or ox. The third beast had the face of a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. Huh? Wait a minute. Does John make a mistake? He says that there's four creatures, and it seems that he's saying each beast has one of a face of a man, one the face of an ox, one of a lion. There's a mistake there, right? Well, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Could it be that the perspective of John was different than the perspective of Ezekiel? I don't have a problem with that. If you could see the different faces from all angles, maybe Isaiah or Ezekiel had a different vantage point. But perhaps John just saw more of a one-dimensional view of those creatures, just seeing each one with its distinct face. Or it could be the difference between a seraphim and a cherubim. You don't know. I mean, there's no big controversy there, although people try to make stuff of that, which I think is nonsense. But either way, I find it interesting that there are such similarities. Now you say, what's the deal with the lion, the man, the ox, and the eagle? Well, see, again, Ezekiel would have exactly known what this was a symbol of. Now, I don't want to belabor the point or make it too studious or whatever, but if you're interested, you can study there in the Levitical laws and in the book of Exodus and what have you. You'll come to places that you read about stuff and you think, what does this have to do with anything? They actually give the description of how the people of Israel were to encamp in their wilderness wanderings. And do you guys remember what was in the center of the camp? The priests, the Levites, right? So the Levites were right there in the middle. Then there were four divisions of the 12 tribes of Israel. And each tribe was kind of led, each group of tribes were led by a single tribe. For example, to the west, there was the tribe of Judah. Pardon me, the camp of Ephraim. And there to the west, Ephraim, they included Manasseh and Benjamin, which was about, according to Bible times, over 100,000 people. And they would camp to the west. Then you'd get the camp of Reuben, which included the Simeon and Gad, and they would encamp to the south. And then you had the camp of Dan to the north, which included Naphtali and Asher. And then you had the camp of Judah, which, by the way, was a huge group of people, to the east. And there to the east you had with Judah, Issachar and Zebulun. You say, Brett, what's the deal with that? Well, do you remember each one of those had a standard or a flag that was to represent them? Do you remember that? And if you remember in our studies, in our previous studies, the camp of Reuben had a man face as his flag. The camp of Ephraim had the ox. The camp of Judah had the lion. And the camp of Dan had the eagle. Now this is interesting because the tabernacle, where the priests, the Levites in the center, would minister, it would be right there in the center. And the thing is, the tabernacle was always a picture or a paradigm of what? Huh? Somebody said it. One person said it. Jesus Christ, the tabernacle. Beautiful portrait of Jesus Christ, okay? And we looked at all that years ago when we were in Exodus and Numbers and what have you. But here's the thing. If you were to look at an aerial photo, if you went on Google Earth back then, if you could have, you would notice that it made an interesting shape. First of all, it would be the shape like the throne of God that's described in Ezekiel and in the book of Revelation. The throne of God. Using the same symbols that Ezekiel and Isaiah and John employs in their picture of the snapshot of the throne of God. You see, if you really look at this thing, you'll think, oh, this is like a picture of the throne of God. Now, there's another thing that I find intriguing. When you look at the numbers of the people that are encamped in their encampment with those symbols and all that, it also forms the perfect shape of a cross. Kind of interesting. You got those four tribes here, four tribes there, four tribes there. Pardon me, three tribes here, three there, and three there. And you've got the tribe of Judah, which is the big one, forming the shape of a cross with the tabernacle in the middle. Beautiful portrait. All of these things, you have to understand, the book that is in your hands is this intricate message system. It's not just stories from the Bible, an old bunch of stories and weird writings of stuff. No, everything is somehow intermingled, intertwined, and I find that really interesting. Now, we could go into all kinds of things with these faces. There's some interesting teachings given, for example, on the Gospels, the four Gospels, and each of these four faces represent the four Gospels in some way, shape, or form. You know, for example, you've got here, you've got the face of a man. You've got the lion. You got the eagle. The lion speaks of what? The lion of the tribe of Judah, Jesus Christ, as the lion, the king of beasts, if you would, the king. And so Matthew is the Gospel to the Jews, speaking of Jesus as king, Jesus as Messiah, king of the Jews. And there's that correlation. And they go on and talk about, you know, the ox being the servant, whereas Mark presents Jesus as servant. And so the ox is the gospel of Mark. And it goes on and talks about the correlations. These are things you can study if you're interested. You can check them out. Look up some great, great writings and stuff. In fact, a guy by the name of Edersheim did some interesting stuff on this, and he was an ancient writer of these kinds of things. But be that as it may, the picture that Ezekiel is seeing is full of meaning, and we just are running out of time. Great stuff, though. So we come to that next section, which is now the wheels that he sees. These wheels, mysterious. It says, verse 15, "Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a barrel." Apparently brown with metal straps around it. No, just kidding. It's a barrel is a very glorious color that we're not exactly sure exactly what it was. "And they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel." So Ezekiel, I got to get them changed gears here in my mind. Ezekiel, he is seeing sort of this gyroscopic wheel that's going around, wheels within a wheel. Man, this is high tech, especially for a guy like Ezekiel. And it says, verse 17, "When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. As for their rings," these wheels had rings, "they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Whithersoever the spirit was to go, they went, thither was their spirit to go. And their wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels." This is high-tech science fiction here. The wheels had the spirit of the cherubims in these little wheels that seemed to be floating around them, near them, by them. And wherever they went, these wheels would go with them, turning but stopping with eyes on them. What does it mean, Brett? I haven't the foggiest idea. But there is something interesting about these, where when the spirit moved, the spirit of the wheels moved in conjunction with the spirit. It would seem the spirit of God. Verse 21, "When those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. When those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels." The point is, these amazing creatures were submitted to the Lord, just doing what the Spirit, their spirits were linked, if you could say that. Whatever the Spirit of God was doing, the Spirit of the wheels were doing. And man, that's what I pray for all of us, that we would have that kind of congruity just with the Lord, just totally following the Lord in every way, shape, and form. So these cherubim are beings, or angelic beings to follow, to model ourselves after in some ways. Well, that brings us to the firmament, or the great expanse, number 3 on the list of things to cover in this chapter. It says, and the likeness of the firmament was upon the heads of the living creature, was the color of the terrible crystal stretched forth over their heads above. And under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Everyone had two which covered on this side, and everyone had two which covered on that side their bodies. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, voice of speech. By the way, for you Bible students, do you remember another time where the Lord's voice was compared to voice of many waters? Book of Revelation. Same exact description of the Lord's voice. Now, the voice has the voice of the Lord is many waters. I think the Lord sometimes, his voice is like the Niagara Falls. You know, where the Lord just speaks to you, many waters, and you're just hearing him, you know. But there's other times where I think the Lord's voice is like many waters, only just little tiny drips, quiet, still small voice. But his voice is like the voice of many waters. And it says, as the noise of a host, when they stood and let down their wings, there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads when they stood and had let down their wings. So these flying creatures, their wings made this great noise, like the voice of the Almighty. And that brings us to the fourth image that we see, and that is the throne. By the way, some people, I should probably say this, some people liken these creatures to being images of God, who God really is. And I would disagree with that notion. I'll just tell you why. It's simple. One of the big ten is thou shalt not create or, you know, make unto thee any graven image. Making an image of God is strictly forbidden. And so I believe these are simply, just as it states, cherubim that are in heaven, that are impressive beings that we can watch and even perhaps model ourselves after. But now we're going to see the image of the throne and even he that sits upon the throne. Verse 26. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. Again, Book of Revelation talks about that. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of a man above upon it. Who would be the one who has the appearance of the man seated upon the throne? Jesus Christ. God becomes a man. And I believe we're seeing that vision of that. Verse 27, and I saw the color of amber. Same word as we saw there in verse 4. And as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. And it was brightness, or had brightness round about. So basically, you look at the Lord, you're seeing brightness. Bright. No man can see God and live, the Bible says. That's an interesting thing, a different, interesting quote. But check it out. It goes on, verse 28. As the appearance of the bow. What kind of bow are we talking about? The rainbow. We saw that in Revelation 4 that we read tonight, right? The rainbow is right there in the throne that is in the cloud. Remember, the rainbow is the covenant of God to the earth to not destroy the earth by flooding again. It was a promise of God. There it is in heaven. And it's the cloud in the day of rain. So was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face. And I heard the voice of the one that spake. Falling on the face. Whenever you see somebody see the throne of God, or seeing God in any way, shape, or form, you always see them falling flat on their face. So one thing that you'll need to do when you're tour guide in heaven, be ready for that. So we're just get to heaven, all of a sudden, wham, you find yourself lemon fresh smell on the heavenly floor. You can look over to the verse. Yeah, this is the time where we fall on our flat on our face because we're in the presence of God. Let me read you Exodus 24. Interesting little story. Then went Moses up. This is going up on the mountain. with Nadab, Abihu, and Aaron, and 70 the elders of Israel. And when they saw the God of Israel, there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. What did God look like? We don't know. It says, and when they saw the God of heaven, the floor looked like this, sapphire stone. You see what I'm saying? That's all they could say. That's the only description. They saw the God. Well, what did God look like? We don't know. Our nose is still kind of hurt. Well, in the same way, Ezekiel's flat on his face. But what happens? Quickly, chapter 2. And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. And the Spirit entered into me when he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet, that I heard him that spake unto me. Would you make note? God's commandments are his enablements. Notice here it says that Jeremiah, stand on your feet. But then what does it say? Does Jeremiah then jumped upon his feet? No, it says, then the Spirit of the Lord entered into me when he spake unto me and set me upon my feet. See, Ezekiel got so flattened, he wasn't able to stand up. Then the Lord says, stand up. But whenever God says to do something, the Holy Spirit will give Ezekiel the power to do what he's telling us to do. I kind of like that. Stand up, Ezekiel. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to give you my Spirit to help you stand up. And the Spirit sets him back up. Don't ever chicken out. When the Lord says, I want you to go share and witness to that person. Go, oh, but I don't know what to say. And I don't know the Bible good enough. And all that. Hey, if the Lord has commanded you to do it, he's also going to give you the enablement. Whatever you need, he will enable you to do it. And that's what we see here with Ezekiel. And he said unto me, Son of man, I send thee to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this very day. For they are impudent children, stiff-hearted. I do send thee unto them, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord God. And they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there hath been a prophet among them. And thou, son of man, be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words, though briars and thorns be with thee, and thou dost dwell among the scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their rebellious or at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. And thou shalt speak my words unto them, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. For they are most rebellious. What's the Lord trying to say to Ezekiel? Children of Israel are rebellious, and you're their teacher. You're the one who gets to share with them, and they're not going to listen to you, is basically what he's saying. Now, here's the thing I want to tell you. If the Lord tells you to preach or teach someone or share the gospel with someone, do you know that it's not your responsibility to make sure they walk away saved or having heard and receive the truth? This is something I've had to learn kind of the hard way. Because I would sit down with somebody in the church office, you know, years ago as I was a young pastor down in Southern Oregon. And I would just with all my heart try to convince people, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's what the Bible says. And man, with all my heart, I'd try to pour in. And they would just kind of go, and they'd walk away. Oh, I just want to chase after them. Say, no, listen to me. You know, because it's just the truth of the word. But listen, that is not my responsibility. My responsibility is to speak the truth. Yes, as effectively as I possibly can. But at the same time, even as Ezekiel's, the Lord said, you need to go and preach to them, speak to them my words. They're not going to hear you, but the Lord has a whole nother agenda. He wants the people to know there is a prophet among them, whether they listen to him or not. Did Jesus chase after the rich young ruler when the rich young ruler, hey, what do I need to do? Sell everything you have, give to the poor, follow me. And the guy walked away weeping because he knew he couldn't do it. Did Jesus chase after him? Hey, wait a minute. I told you to sell your stuff. Is that what he did? No. Jesus just stood there and watched him walk away. That's heavy. You see, your responsibility is not necessarily to see people saved, lives changed. Oh, that's the icing on the cake when it does happen. But your responsibility and my responsibility is to be faithful servants of the Lord and do what he tells us to do. And really, we need to measure success in ministry is not as much on numbers of people saved or how many people go to our church or how many people you've pulled out of drunkenness or drug addiction. The thing you need to measure is say, how faithful have I been to God's call upon my life? That's what we need to do. And the problem is, you know, this Christmas season, this Thanksgiving, perhaps you're going to find yourself faced with those calls of God to speak boldly to those people you love. Family members are the hardest ones. Have you found that to be true? Man, you can talk about Jesus with anybody, but as soon as your parents come in the room, or your brother or sister, or cousins, aunts, uncles, it's a little weird and awkward. And we often, don't want to freak everybody out. We come up with excuses as to why we don't do it, but we need to just be faithful. I was reading about excuses, actual excuses for missing school that were turned in by students that the parents apparently wrote. Here's one letter. My son is under the doctor's care and could not take PE yesterday. Please execute him. I like this one. Please excuse Cynthia for being absent. She was sick and I had her shot. Please excuse Tom for being absent on January 28th, 29th, 30th, 31st, 32nd, and 33rd. Please excuse Danny for being... It was his father's fault. June could not come to school yesterday because she was bothered by very close veins. Very close veins. Richard had an acre in his side. Please excuse Timothy for being absent last week. He could not talk because of Larry angitis. Oh man, you know, excuses are painful. You know, as soon as you become good at making excuses, that's all you'll be good at. That's what one of my old teachers used to tell me. As soon as you become good at making excuses, that's all you'll be good at. And honestly, the Lord was saying, Jeremiah, I don't want you to have an excuse. In fact, we close this evening where he says this in verse 8, but thou, son of man, remember that word son of man is a title that he gives to Ezekiel. Did I say Jeremiah again? Oh man, you know who I'm talking about. he says to Ezekiel, he says, the son of man. Now that's the title he's going to give Ezekiel 92 times in this book. So get used to that. That's an important title. But he says, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that I give thee. And when I looked, behold, a hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein, and he spread it before me, and it was written within and without, and there was it was written therein, lamentations, mourning, and woe. And of course, we looked at that on Sunday, those last two verses and the first three or four verses of chapter 3. But we close where the Lord's saying, don't be rebellious, Ezekiel. Speak the words that I give you, and I'm going to have you eat up these words. Don't be rebellious like the people, but just be faithful. That's what he's calling him to do. And man, I think that's what the Lord's calling us to do, is to be faithful people who are willing to share the gospel message this Christmas season, particularly as we get closer and closer, to just be faithful people. Amen?